Desperation by Stephen King. Read by Kathy Bates. Part 1. Highway 50. In the house of the wolf, the house of the scorpion. Oh, Jesus. Gross. What, Mary, what? Didn't you see it?
See what?
She looked at him, and in the harsh desert sunlight, he saw that a lot of the color had gone out of her face, leaving just the marks of sunburn on her cheeks and across her brow, where not even a strong sunblock cream would entirely protect her. She was very fair and burned easily.
On that sign, the speed limit sign.
What about it?
There was a dead cat on it, Peter. Nailed there, glued there, some damn thing.
He hit the brake pedal. She grabbed his shoulder at once. Don't you even think about going back.
Was it a white cat?
He could see the back of the sign in the rearview mirror, but that was all. When they'd passed it, he'd been looking off in the other direction, at some birds flying toward the nearest wedge of mountains. Strictly attending to the highway was not something one had to do at every second out here. Nevada called its stretch of U.S. 50 the loneliest highway in America. And in Peter Jackson's opinion, it lived up to its billing. Of course, he was a New York boy, and he supposed he might be suffering a cumulative case of the creeps.
No, it was a tiger stripe, she said. What difference does it make?
I thought maybe Satanists in the desert, he said. This place is supposed to be filled with weirdos. Isn't that what Mary L. said?
Intense was the word she used, Mary said. But since we haven't seen anybody since we crossed the California state line...
Well, in Fallon, pit stops don't count, she said. Although even there, the people... She gave him a funny, helpless look.
Why are they here, Pete?
I mean, I can understand Vegas and Reno, but...
You sure that wasn't a white cat? Or a black one?
He glanced back into the rear view, but the speed limit sign had already faded into a mottled background of sand, mesquite, and dull brown foothills. There was finally another vehicle behind them, though. He could see a hot sun star reflection pricking off its windshield. Maybe a mile back. Maybe two.
No, Tiger Stripe, I told you. Answer my question. Who are the Central Nevada taxpayers, and what's in it for them?
He shrugged. Well, there aren't many taxpayers out here. Fallon's the biggest town on Highway 50, and that's mostly farming.
I'd leave, she said. Any state where you can't see a house or even a tree in any direction and they nail cats to speed limit signs, I'd leave.
Are you sorry we came this way? He glanced up into the rear view and saw the vehicle behind them was closer now. Not a truck, which was just about all they'd seen since leaving Fallon, but a car, really burning up the road, too. She thought about it, then shook her head.
No, it was good to see Gary and Marielle.
And Lake Tahoe. Beautiful, wasn't it?
Incredible.
Even this, Mary looked out the window. It's not without beauty, I'm not saying that, but it's...
Creepy,
he finished for her. If you're from New York, at least. He looked into the mirror again, the lenses of the glasses he wore for driving glinting in the sun. The oncomer was a police car, doing at least 80. He squeezed over toward the shoulder until the right-hand wheels began to rumble on the hard pan and spume up dust.
Pete, what are you doing?
Making myself small, Peter said. There's a cop behind us and he's in a hurry. Maybe he's got a line on... The police car blasted by, making the Acura, which belonged to Peter's sister, rock in its backwash. There was a decal on the side, but the car was gone before Pete caught more than a glimpse of it. D.E.S. something. Destry, maybe. That was a good name for a Nevada town out here in the Big Lonely. On the guy who nailed the cat to the speed limit sign, Peter finished. The police car's taillights suddenly came on. Peter hit his own brake without even thinking of it. Then the cruiser swerved over into the westbound lane.
What's he doing? Mary asked.
I don't know exactly.
But of course he knew.
He was slowing down. Frowning, not wanting to catch up, and not knowing why, Peter slowed even more himself. The speedometer of Deirdre's car dropped toward 40.
Peter? Mary sounded alarmed. Peter, I don't like this.
It's all right, he said.
But was it?
He stared at the cop car, now tooling slowly up the westbound lane to his left, and wondered. A tumbleweed bounced into the road, and the cruiser's radial tires crushed it under. It came out the back, looking to Peter Jackson, like a nestle of broken fingers. All at once, he was frightened, very close to terror, in fact, and he hadn't the slightest idea why.
What does he want, Pete?
By now, that was pretty obvious. To be behind us again.
What are you going to...
Go by, of course. He pushed down on the accelerator and immediately began to catch up with the dusty cruiser, which was now floating along at no more than 20. Mary grabbed the shoulder of his blue work shirt, hard enough for him to feel the pressure of her short fingernails.
No, don't.
Mare, there's not a lot else I can do. And the conversation was already obsolete because he was going by even as he spoke. Deirdre's Acura drew even with the dusty white Caprice, then passed it. Peter looked through two pieces of glass and saw very little. A big shape. A man shape. That was about all. Peter glanced down at the decal on the passenger door. Now he had time to read it. Desperation Police Department, in gold letters below the town seal, which appeared to be a miner and a horseman shaking hands. Desperation, he thought. Even better than Destry. Much better. As soon as he was past, the white car swung back into the eastbound lane, speeding up to stay on the Acura's bumper. Then the blue flashers on the Caprice's roof came on. Peter felt a sinking in his stomach, but it wasn't surprise. Not at all.
I don't like it, Mary said, looking nervously around. There was nothing to look at but desert, foothills, and leagues of blue sky.
What were we doing?
Speeding seems logical.
He was looking in the outside mirror. Above the words, "Caution, objects may be closer than they appear," he saw the dusty white driver's door of the cop car swing open. A khaki leg swung out. It was prodigious. As the man it belonged to followed it out, swung the door of his cruiser closed, and settled his smoky bear hat on his head, Mary turned around to look.
Holy God! He's the size of a football player!
At least, Peter said. The cop stopped beside Peter's window, the buckle of his Sam Brown belt on a level with Peter's eyes. He did not bend, but raised one fist. To Peter it looked the size of a daisy-canned ham, and made cranking gestures. Peter took off his round, rimless glasses, tucked them into his pocket, and rolled his window down. The cop did a slow, smooth, deep knee bend, bringing his huge and noncommittal face into the Jackson's field of vision. His skin was an uncomfortable-looking pink, and Peter guessed that for all his size, this man got along with the sun no better than Mary did. His eyes were bright gray, direct, but with no emotion in them. None that Peter could read, anyway. He could smell something, though. He thought maybe Old Spice. The cop's eyes lingered on the pulled-out ashtray. Peter guessed he was looking for roaches, sniffing for the lingering aroma of pot or hash, and felt relieved. He hadn't smoked a joint in nearly 15 years. Mary had never bothered with the stuff at all. She sometimes referred to herself as a drug virgin. There was nothing in the pulled-out ashtray but a couple of balled-up juicy fruit wrappers.
"Officer, I know I was going a little fast. Had the hammer down, did you?"
the cop asked pleasantly.
"Gosh, now. Sir, could I see your driver's license and your registration?"
"Sure." Peter took his wallet out of his back pocket.
"The car's not mine, though. It's my sister's. We're driving it back to New York for her. From Oregon. She was at Reed. Reed College in Portland."
He was babbling. He knew it, but wasn't sure he could stop it. It was weird how cops could get you babbling like this, as if you had a dismembered body or a kidnapped child in the trunk.
"Mayor, would you get the registration out of the glove compartment? It's in a little plastic envelope along with Dee's insurance papers."
At first she didn't move. He could see her out of the corner of his eye, just sitting still, as he opened his wallet and began hunting for his driver's license. It should have been right there, in one of the windowed compartments in front of the billfold, big as life. But it wasn't.
"Mayor?"
he asked again, a little impatient now and a little frightened all over again. What if he'd lost his goddamn driver's license somewhere? He hadn't, of course, but wouldn't it just be typical?
A little help, Mayor. Get the damned registration, please.
She bent forward like some old rusty piece of machinery goosed into life by a sudden jolt of electricity and opened the glove compartment. She began to root through it.
She started, and then, with unmistakable relief, "Oh, here it is."
At the same moment, Peter looked in the compartment where he kept business cards and saw his license. He couldn't remember putting it in there. The name of God would he have? But there it was. In the photograph, he looked not like an assistant professor of English at NYU, but an unemployed petty laborer and possible serial killer. Yet it was him, recognizably him, and he felt his spirits lift.
He took out Deirdre's registration and held it out to the cop, but the cop was still looking at his license.
"I see you're an organ donor," the cop said without looking up. "Do you really think that's wise?"
Peter was nonplussed. "Well, I..."
"Is that the vehicle registration, sir?"
the cop asked crisply. He was now looking at the canary yellow sheet of paper.
"Yes."
Peter handed it out the window. Now the cop, still squatting Indian fashion in the sunlight, had Peter's driver's license in one hand and Deirdre's registration in the other. He looked back and forth between them for what seemed a very long time.
"Your sister?" the cop said finally. "Her name is Finney. Yours is Jackson."
"Deirdre was married for a year between high school and college," Mary said.
"A year? Hmm. Married. Puck!"
His head remained down over the documents. Peter could see the peak of his smoky bear hat ticking back and forth as he fell to examining them again. Peter's sense of relief was slipping away. The cop looked up.
"Would you step out of the car, please, Mr. Jackson?"
Suddenly, his balls in the pit of his stomach were crawling with dismay, and he felt like a child, a confused child who only knows for sure that he has done something bad.
"What?"
he began. The cop from the Desperation Cruiser stood. It was like watching a freight elevator go up. Then Peter was looking at the heavy belt buckle again, the gun, and the khaki fold of cloth over the man's fly. This time, what came from above the top of the window wasn't a question.
"Get out of the car, Mr. Jackson!"
Peter pulled the handle, and the cop stood back so he could swing the door open. He got out onto the asphalt of U.S. 50, standing on legs that felt queerly distant. The cop was looking down at him. 6'7", Peter thought. Gotta be.
"Step around to the rear of the car, Mr. Jackson."
The cop stopped beside the trunk. When Peter joined him, he pointed with one big finger. Peter followed it and saw there was no license plate on the back of Deirdre's car, just a marginally cleaner rectangle where it had been.
"Ah, shit,"
he said, and his irritation and dismay were real enough, but so was the relief beneath them. All this had had a point after all. Thank God.
"Mayor! Hey, Mayor! Our damn license plate fell off," he called, almost laughing.
"No, it didn't,"
the Desperation cop said. He squatted again, that calm, slow, lithe movement, and reached beneath the bumper. He fumbled there for a moment or two, his gray eyes gazing off toward the horizon.
"Ah," the cop said.
He stood up again. The hand he had been investigating with was clenched into a loose fist. He held it out to Peter and opened it. Lying on his palm was a road-dirty piece of screw. It was bright in only one place, where it had been sheared off. Peter looked at it, then up at the cop.
"I don't get it. Did you stop in Fallon?"
"No." There was a creak as Mary's door opened, a clunk as she shut it behind her, then the scuff of her sneakers on the sandy shoulder as she walked toward the back of the car.
"Sure we did," she said. "Pit stop, Peter, don't you remember? We didn't need gas, but we got soda so we wouldn't feel guilty about asking to use the restrooms."
She looked at the cop and tried on a smile. He nodded.
"Was that Fillmore Fast or Burke's Conoco you stopped at?"
She glanced uncertainly at Peter. "I don't remember," he said.
"But I bet you remember the kids hanging around outside. Older kids, mostly. One or two, maybe too old to actually be kids at all. The younger ones with skateboards or on rollerblades."
Peter nodded.
"That was the Fillmore Fast. Alfie Burke won't have them around anymore. Kicked them the hell out. They're a dastardly bunch."
Mary cocked her head at that, and for a moment, Peter could see the ghost of a smile at the corners of her mouth. The cop raised Peter's license to his face, looked at it, looked at Peter, lowered it again.
"One of their hobbies is kiffing out-of-state license plates. It's like a dare thing."
"Well, what should we do about the missing plate?" Peter asked. "I mean, this is a mess. We can't very well drive all the way across the country with no license plate on the back of the car, can we?" The cop walked toward the front of the Acura, moving very deliberately. When he reached the front of the car, he put his hands behind his back and stood frowning down at something. To Peter, he looked like an interested patron in an art gallery. "Dastardly," he'd said. "A dastardly bunch." Peter didn't think he'd ever actually heard that word used in conversation.
"The front plate's okay," the cop said. "But that one on the back. You won't have any problem getting to New York on that basis."
"Oh," Peter said. "Okay, good idea."
Do you have a wrench and screwdriver?
The cop grinned. It lit his whole face, informed his eyes, turned him into a different man.
Oh, these are yours.
He held out the license and registration.
There's a little toolkit in the trunk, I think, Mary said.
She sounded giddy, and that was how Peter felt. Pure relief, he supposed.
I saw it while I was putting in my makeup case, between the spare tire and the side.
Peter walked to the driver's door of the car, wondering why he and Mary had been so afraid in the first place. That's nonsense, he told himself, as he pulled the keys out of the ignition switch. They were on a smiley face keychain, which was pretty much par for the course. Deirdre's course, anyway. Mr. Smiley Smile was his sister's trademark. She put happy yellow ones on the flaps of most of her letters, the occasional green one with a downturned mouth and a blah tongue stuck out if she happened to be having a bad day. I wasn't afraid. Not really. Neither was Mary.
Boink. A lie. He had been afraid. And Mary? Well, Mary had been damn close to terrified.
Okay, maybe we were a little freaked, he thought, picking out the trunk key as he walked to the back of the car again. So sue us. The sight of Mary standing next to the big cop was like some sort of optical illusion. The top of her head barely came up to the bottom of his ribcage. He opened the trunk. On the left, neatly packed, were Deirdre's clothes. In the center, Mary's makeup case and their two suitcases, his and hers, were wedged in between the bundles and the spare tire. It was one of those blow-up donuts, good for a run to the nearest service station. He looked between the donut and the trunk sidewall. There was nothing there.
Mare, I don't see...
There, she pointed. That gray thing, that's it. It's worked its way in back of the spare, that's all. He could have snaked his arm into the gap, but it seemed easier just to lift the uninflated rubber donut out of the way. He was leaning it against the back bumper when he heard Mary's sudden intake of breath.
Oh, hey, the big cop said mildly. What's this?
Mary and the cop were looking into the trunk. The cop looked interested and slightly bemused. Mary's eyes were bulging, horrified. There was something in the spare tire well. For a moment, he either didn't know what it was or didn't want to know what it was, and then that crawling sensation started in his lower belly again. The big cop gave him a look, those bright gray eyes still peculiarly empty, then reached into the spare tire well and brought out a baggie, a big one, a gallon size, and stuffed full of greenish-brown herbal matter. The flap had been sealed with strapping tape. Plastered on the front was a round yellow sticker, Mr. Smiley Smile, the perfect emblem for potheads like his sister, whose adventures in life could have been titled Through Darkest America with Bong and Roach Clip. The cop squeezed the baggie with one oversized thumb as if it were a tomato. He held out his other hand, palm up.
Give me your keys, sir, he said.
Officer, I can explain this.
Give me your keys.
He only raised his voice a little, but it was enough to start Mary crying.
Afraid you folks are going to have to come with me,
the cop said. His eyes went from Peter to Mary, and then back to Peter again.
Please, Mary said, her voice wet. It's a mistake. His sister...
Get in the car, the cop said, indicating his cruiser. Right now, please, Mr. and Mrs. Jackson.
The rear seat was extremely cramped. Of course it would be, Peter thought distractedly. A man that big would have the front seat back as far as it would go. There was mesh between the front of the car and the back, and no handles or window cranks on the doors. Peter found himself with a powerful urge to tell Officer Friendly that a terrible mistake had been made here. He was an assistant professor of English. His specialty was post-war American fiction. He had recently published a scholarly article called James Dickey and the New Southern Reality, and furthermore, that he hadn't smoked dope in years. He looked at Mary.
Pete, I'm so scared,
she said in a whisper that was almost a moan. He leaned forward and kissed her cheek.
It'll be all right. We'll straighten this out.
After putting them into the back seat of the cruiser, the cop had returned to the Acura. He had been looking into the trunk for at least 2 minutes now, just staring in, with his hands clasped behind his back as if mesmerized. Now he jerked like a man waking suddenly from a nap, slammed the Acura's trunk shut, took the keys, put them in his own pocket, and walked back to the Caprice. It canted to the left when he got in, and from the springs beneath there came a tired but somehow resigned groan. The back seat bulged a little further, and Peter grimaced at the sudden pressure on his knees. Mary should have taken this side, he thought, but it was too late now. Peter sat back. His knees were still being pinched pretty severely, but he thought he could live with it, and looked out the dust-coated side window. He could see something up ahead, pulled over on the shoulder of the westbound lane. Some sort of vehicle. Big. It was an RV. The vehicle was road dusty and canted over in an awkward, unnatural way. As they neared it, Peter saw an odd thing. All three of the tires in his view appeared to be flat. He thought maybe the front tire on the passenger side was flat, too, although he only caught the briefest glimpse of it. They went past the RV. The side door was closed but unlatched. The steps were down. There was a doll lying in the dirt at the foot of them. The dress it was wearing fluttered in the wind. "Do we impress you as stupid people?" Mary was asking as the disabled RV began to dwindle behind them. "Or stoned? Do you think we're..."
"Shut up," the cop said. "I'm arresting you and your husband on a charge of possession of marijuana with intent to sell."
His voice was uninflected, robotic. Now, staring forward, Peter saw there was a little plastic bear stuck to the dashboard beside the compass and next to what was probably an LED readout for the radar speed gun. His neck was on a spring, and his empty, painted eyes stared back at Peter. "This is a nightmare," he thought, knowing it wasn't.
"You can't be serious," Mary said, but her voice was tiny and shocked. "You have the right to remain silent," the big cop said in his robot's voice. "If you do not choose to remain silent, anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. I'm going to kill you. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you. Do you understand your rights as I have explained them to you?"
She was looking at Peter, her eyes huge and horrified, asking him without speaking if he had heard what the cop had mixed in with the rest of it, that robotic voice never varying. Peter nodded. He had heard all right. He put an arm around Mary and could feel her trembling. The cop turned his head then. His face, pinkish with sun when he had stopped them, had gone pale. He had bitten his lip, like a man trying to suppress some monstrous rage, and blood ran down his chin in a thin stream.
"Do you understand your rights?"
The cops screamed at them, head turned, bulleting blind down the deserted two-lane at better than 70 miles an hour.
"Do you understand your rights or not? Answer me, you smart New York Jew!"
"I do," Peter cried. "We both do. Just watch the road, for Christ's sake. Watch where you're going." The cop continued staring back at them through the mesh, face pale, blood dripping down from his lower lip. The Caprice, which had begun to veer to the left, almost all the way across the westbound lane, now slid back the other way.
"Don't worry about me," the cop said. His voice was mild again. "Gosh, no. I've got eyes in the back of my head. In fact, I've got eyes just about everywhere. You'd do well to remember that."
He turned back suddenly, facing front again, and dropped the cruiser's speed to an easygoing 55. The seat settled back against Peter's knees with painful weight pinning him. He took Mary's hands in both of his own. She pressed her face against his chest, and he could feel the sobs she was trying to suppress.
"I see holes like eyes," the cop said. "My mind is full of them."
He said nothing else until they got to town. The next 10 minutes were very slow ones for Peter Jackson. He understood that he and Mary were in the worst trouble of their lives, but he was unable to comprehend this in any real and meaningful way. Every time he neared comprehension, there was a short circuit in his head. Mary nudged him and pointed out her window. Here was a sign reading simply, "Desperation." Under the word was an arrow pointing to the right. The cop slowed, but not much, before making the turn. He felt the cruiser's rear end first slide, then catch hold. A moment later, they were racing south along narrow, patched blacktop with no center line. A mile or so further on, they passed a sign which read, "Desperation's Church and Civic Organizations Welcome You." The words "Church and Civic Organizations" were readable, although they had been coated with yellow spray paint. Above them, in the same paint, the words "Dead Dogs" had been added in ragged caps. A German shepherd had been hung from the sign. Its rear paws tick-tocked back and forth an inch or two above a patch of ground that was dark and muddy with its blood. They passed a trailer park behind a stake fence. Beyond the Rattlesnake Trailer Park was a long Quonset hut with rusty corrugated sides and roof. The sign out front read, Desperation Mining Corp. To one side was a cracked asphalt parking lot with a dozen cars and pickups in it. Then they were in the town proper. Desperation, Nevada consisted of two streets that crossed at right angles. A blinker light currently flashing yellow on all four sides hung over the intersection, and two blocks of business buildings. There was an Owl Club casino and cafe, a grocery, a laundromat, a bar with a sign in the window reading, Enjoy Our Slotspitality, a combination hardware and feed store, a movie theater called the American West, a few others. None of the businesses looked as if they were booming, and the theater had the air of a place that has been closed a long time. A single crooked R hung from its dirty, bashed-in marquee. Beyond the town was an enormous curving bulwark with an improved dirt road at least four lanes wide running up to the top in a pair of wide switchbacks. The rest of this curved rampart, which had to be at least 300 feet high, was crisscrossed by deep runoff trenches. Their host spoke up for the first time since telling them his mind was full holes or whatever it was he'd said.
Rattlesnake number two, sometimes known as the China Pit.
He sounded like a tour guide who still enjoys his job.
Old number two was opened in 1951, and from 62 or so right through the 70s, it was the biggest open-pit copper mine in the United States. Then it played out. They opened it up again year before last. They got some new technology that makes even the tailings valuable. Science, huh? Gosh.
But there was nothing moving up there now. Not that Peter could see, although it was a weekday. The cop drove through the center of town, and as they passed beneath the blinker, Mary squeezed Peter's hands twice in rapid succession. He followed her gaze and saw three bikes in the middle of the street, which crossed Main. They had been set on their seats in a row, with their wheels sticking up. The wheels were turning like windmill blades in the gusty air. She turned to look at him, her wet eyes wider than ever. The cop swung into a small, recently paved parking lot bordered on three sides by brick walls. There were four or five cars in the lot. There was a single handicapped space. Officer Friendly parked in it. He turned off the engine and then just sat there for a moment or two, head lowered, fingers tapping restlessly at the steering wheel, humming under his breath.
"Don't kill us," Mary said suddenly in a trembling, teary voice. "We'll do whatever you want. Just please don't kill us."
"Shut your quacking Jew mouth," the cop replied.
He didn't raise his head, and he went on tapping at the wheel with the tips of his sausage-sized fingers. "We're not Jews," Peter heard himself saying. His voice sounded not afraid, but querulous, angry. "We're, well, Presbyterians, I guess. What's this Jew thing?" Mary looked at her husband, horrified, then back through the mesh to see how the cop was taking it. At first he did nothing, only sat with his head down and his fingers tapping. Then he grabbed his hat and got out of the car. The cop bent and opened the left rear door. They slid out, Peter first.
"We're going to walk around to the front of the municipal building," the cop said. "That'll be a left as you reach the sidewalk."
They walked. Their footfalls on the fresh black tar seemed very loud. Peter kept thinking of the little plastic bear on the dashboard of the cruiser, its jiggling head and painted eyes. Who had given it to the cop? A favorite niece? A daughter?
"To your left, Dumbo," the cop said, sounding not impatient but resigned. "Do you know which way is your left? Won't they teach hayfoot and strawfoot to you New York homo Presbyterians?"
They came to a set of three stone steps leading up to modern tinted glass double doors. The cop stopped at the foot of the steps and looked at the Jacksons curiously.
"You're Peter."
"Yes, Peter Jackson." He wet his lips. The cop shifted his eyes.
"And you're Mary."
"That's right."
"So where's Paul?"
the cop asked, looking at them pleasantly.
"What?" Peter asked. "I don't understand. How can you sing 500 miles or leaving on a jet plane without Paul?"
the cop asked, and opened the right-hand door. Machine-cooled air puffed out. Peter felt it on his face and had time to register how good it felt, and then Mary screamed. There was a girl of about six, sprawled at the foot of the stairs, half-propped against the last four risers. Her eyes were wide open, and her head was unnaturally cocked to one side. There was no question in Peter's mind about whom the dolly lying at the foot of the RV's steps had belonged to.
"Gosh,"
the cop said genially. Forgot all about her. But you can never remember everything, can you?
Mary screamed again and tried to bolt back down the steps.
No, you don't. What a bad idea, the cop said.
He caught her by the shoulder and shoved her through the door, which he was holding open. She reeled across the small lobby, revolving her arms in a frantic effort to keep her balance, not wanting to fall on top of the dead child in the jeans and the Moto Cop's 2200 shirt. Peter started in toward his wife, and the cop caught him with both hands, now using his butt to keep the right-hand door open. He slung an arm around Peter's shoulders. His face looked open and friendly. Peter felt an instant's hope, and at first did not associate the thing pressing into his stomach with the cop's monster handgun. He thought of his father, who would sometimes poke him with the tip of his finger while giving him advice, using the finger to sort of tamp his aphorisms home. Things like, "No one ever gets pregnant if one of you keeps your pants on, Petey." He didn't realize it was the gun, not the cop's oversized sausage of a finger, until Mary shrieked, "No! Oh, no!"
"I don't care if you're a Jew or a Hindu," the cop said, hugging Peter against him.
He squeezed Peter's shoulder chummily with his left hand as he cocked the .45 with his right.
"In desperation, we don't care about those things much."
He pulled the trigger at least three times. There might have been more, but three reports were all Peter Jackson heard. An incredible heat shot up through his chest and down through his legs at the same time, and he heard something wet drop on his shoes. He heard Mary still screaming, but the sound seemed to come from far, far away. "Now I'll wake up in my bed," Peter thought, as his knees buckled and the world began to draw away, as bright as afternoon sunlight on the chrome side of a receding railroad car. "Now I'll..." That was all. His last thought, as the darkness swallowed him forever, really wasn't a thought at all, but an image. The bear on the dashboard next to the cop's compass. Head jiggling, painted eyes staring. The eyes turned into holes. The dark rushed out of them, and then he was gone. Ralph Carver was somewhere deep in the black and didn't want to come up. He sensed physical pain waiting, a hangover perhaps, but not just that. Something else. Screaming. Someone was screaming, but distant. Ralph tried to burrow even deeper into the black, but now hands seized his shoulder and began shaking him. Then, shockingly loud, penetrating the blackness like the beam of a powerful light, gunshots. His eyes flew open and he bolted into a sitting position, no idea for a moment where he was or what was happening, only knowing that his head hurt horribly and felt the size of a float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. Ellen looking at him, one eye wide and frantic, the other nearly lost in a puffy complication of blue-black flesh. Screaming somewhere, a woman from below them, maybe... He tried to get on his feet, but his knees wouldn't lock. He fell forward off the bed he was sitting on, landing on his hands and knees. Then he was looking down at his hands through clotted clumps of hair. As he looked at them, sudden memory. "Kirsten, oh Jesus, Ellie Catcher!" burst in his head like a poison firework, and he screamed himself, screamed down at his blood-stained hands, screamed as what he had been trying to burrow away from dropped into his mind like a stone into a pond. The crazy bastard who had brought them here had pushed his 7-year-old daughter down the stairs. Ellie had reached for her, and the crazy bastard had punched his wife in the eye and knocked her down. But Ellie had fallen on the stairs, and Kirsten had plunged down them, her eyes wide open, full of shocked surprise. And then she had hit, feet flying first upward and then backward, and there had been this sound, this awful sound, like a branch breaking under a weight of ice, and suddenly everything about her had changed. He had seen the change even before she came to a stop at the foot of the stairs, as if that was no little girl down there, but a stuffed dummy, headpiece full of straw. "Ralph!" Ellie was tugging at him and panting harshly. "Ralph, get up! Please, get up!" "Dad? Daddy, come on!" That was David, from further away. "Daddy, are you okay?" "Yes," he said. He got one foot planted beneath him, groped for the bunk, and tottered upright. Ellie grabbed him, supported him, helped him forward. They were in a jail cell. In front of him, just out of reach, was the barred door. The bars were painted white, and in some places the paint had dried and hardened in thick runnels. Ralph lunged forward a step and grabbed them. He was looking out at a desk, sitting in the middle of a square floor, like the single bit of stage dressing in a minimalist play. There were papers on it, and a double-barreled shotgun, and a strew of fat green shotgun shells. There were jail cells on three sides of this room. The one in the middle, probably the drunk tank, was large and empty. Ralph and Ellie Carver were in a smaller one. A second small cell to their right was empty. Across from them were two other closet-sized cells. In one of them was their 11-year-old son, David, and a man with white hair. Ralph could see nothing else of this man because he was sitting on the bunk with his head lowered onto his hands. Now there were thuds on the stairs, coming closer and scuffling sounds. Someone was being brought up to join them, but she wasn't coming easily. "We have to help Peter," she was screaming. Her words broke off as she was thrown into the room. She collided with the desk, upper thighs smacking the edge, and then from the other side of the room, David was shrieking at her like a bird, standing at the bars, jumping up and down on the balls of his feet. "The shotgun, lady!" David screamed. "Get the shotgun! Shoot him, lady, shoot him!" The woman looked over her shoulder toward the stairs and the clump of heavy approaching footfalls. "Do it!" Ellie chimed in from beside Ralph. "He killed our daughter! He'll kill all of us! Just do it!" The woman in the jeans and t-shirt grabbed for the gun. Until Nevada, things had been fine. They had started out from Ohio, destination Lake Tahoe. This would be their fourth visit to Nevada, and Ralph would continue to follow his ironclad gambling rule. He would quit when he had either A, lost $1,000, or B, won $10,000. In their three previous trips, he had reached neither of these markers. Once he had gone back to Columbus with $500 of his stake intact, once with $200, and last year he had driven them back with over $3,000 in the inner left-hand pocket of his lucky safari jacket. "Now, you're probably tired of casinos," he'd said in February when they started talking about this vacation. "What about Texas? We could take the kids to see the Alamo." "Too hot. Too historic. Tahoe will be cool, even in July. You like Tahoe, I like Tahoe, the kids like Tahoe. Tahoe is fine." So he had made the reservations. And today, if it still was today, they had been on U.S. 50, headed west across Nevada, toward the High Sierras. David had been sitting beside Ralph, looking out the window with his chin propped on his hand. Earlier, he had been reading the Bible his new pal, the Rev, had given him. Ralph hoped to God that Martin wasn't queer. The man was married, but still, you could never damn tell. But now he'd marked his place and tucked the Bible away in the console storage bin. Ralph had been opening his mouth to ask David to play 20 questions when he felt the Wayfarer steering suddenly go mushy in his hands and heard the highway drone of the tire suddenly become a flapping sound. "Hold on," he had said, and began pumping the brakes. "This could be a little rough." Now standing at the bars and watching the dazed woman who might be their only hope of surviving this nightmare, he thought, "I really had no idea what rough was, did I?" It hurt his head to scream, but he screamed anyway, unaware of how much he sounded like his own son. "Shoot him, lady! Shoot him!" What Mary Jackson remembered, what caused her to reach for the shotgun, even though she had never actually held a gun in her entire life, was the memory of the big cop mixing the words, "I'm going to kill you," into the Miranda warning. She swung around with the gun. The big blonde cop was standing in the doorway, looking at her with his bright gray, empty eyes. Mary stepped back, away from him, and toward the big empty cell at the rear of the room, pulling back both of the shotgun's hammers with the side of her thumb as she retreated. Then she raised it to her shoulder.